I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Our guest, Edward Said, is the most articulate and most familiar Palestinian on the American scene. In recent years, he's famous anew for his break with Yasser Arafat, for his denunciations of the Palestinian Authority that runs the West Bank, and for his washing his hands of the whole peace process that, since Oslo, has begun to normalize politics among Arabs and Jews in and around Israel. It's a peace process in the sky, Edward Said says. It's a conspiracy of government powers to ignore the human reality on the ground, by which he means the impoverishment and humiliation of Palestinians in their Bantustan villages, bullied by Palestinian bureaucrats who are bullied in turn by their Israeli overlords. Grim as Edward Said can sound about the official process, he's also taken a cheerful turn with respect to the personal possibilities of reconciliation. These Palestinian Arabs and Jews have been living on top of each other for centuries, he writes, and he can sound like the Rodney King of Jerusalem asking, in effect, can't we all get along? Connection listeners, do you know why Edward Said despairs about the Middle East? Do you know where he takes comfort, even hope? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Beyond his ranking as the Palestinians' preeminent public intellectual, Edward Said is an accomplished pianist. He's the opera critic for The Nation magazine, an activist who has kept his day job as university professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK or 1-800-423-8255. Welcome, Edward Said. It's a great pleasure and honor to have you on The Connection. I wish you'd just begin by reminding people who may have been on Mars for the last 5 years, when and why you broke with Arafat.
Well, I broke with him in the aftermath, I think, of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, when I felt that he supported that invasion immorally and incorrectly, and then immediately landed in the position of the loser in that war and was forced to accept the rather humiliating conditions, which he made worse, that were set for the peace process that began in Madrid shortly after that. I was involved in the summer of 91 in setting up the terms for Palestinian participation in the peace process. And every one of the things that we set as our, you know, guidelines, he canceled because he wanted to enter no matter what. I mean, he wanted to make himself acceptable to the Americans and the Israelis. And since that time, I think, he's, to my mind, been in a kind of tragic fix. Of course, he has a long history of achievement as, you know, the head of the Palestinian movement in terrible moments of trial and difficulty. But I think at the other hand, he has really not considered his people's best interest in the main interest of staying in power.
How would your guidelines on Madrid have been different? I mean, how would the process had a different result if he'd taken your advice?
Well, obviously, it began when they started negotiating in Washington after Madrid with the Palestinian delegation that came from the West Bank and Gaza. And there were certain things that had to be absolutely held on to. For example, the end of the settlements. The idea of taking more land had to be, you know, absolutely barred. Of course, in all of this, the Israelis had the much stronger hand. They had American support. They were vastly more powerful. They had all the cards. What we had was the Intifada and the support of our people. Progressively and over time, he undercut that delegation in Washington. He fractured our people. He isolated the refugee community from which he came, effectively, which is, you know, by far the largest majority of Palestinians in the diaspora. And he confined himself to being a kind of policeman for the Israelis in Gaza and the West Bank. I mean, it's a very clear pattern, all to stay in power. And that's what they understood. That's what Rabin understood. That's what Peres understood. That's what Netanyahu understood. And that's what Barak understands, that this is a man who can deliver in the end. He's useful to keep him there so that he'll sign. He's a man without any cards. He's become so unpopular now that his appearances are almost always greeted with riots, that he is good only to sign the final agreement, and then he'll be gone.
What would the alternative have been? Would it have been sort of an intifada without end?
No, I don't think so. The Intifada was not without end. There were institutions that were being built. He's brought back all the corrupt old ways. He's brought back the rule of the families. He's brought back the rule of the kind of corrupt middle class that he uses to buy people off. And I think there were interesting things happening. There was a revolution in the schooling process. There was a revolution in the organization of the villages. There was a genuine social transformation. And then don't forget that this is the community of Palestinians all over the world is a very gifted community. He could have drawn on all the talents of Palestinians, the lawyers, the writers, the intellectuals, the teachers. In fact, he's alienated them all. And he's turned us into a community of indifferent and sort of transistorized people who are just watching him give the whole thing away.
Is it gone for the next generation, or will there be...
No, I think it's gone for the time being, and I think what we have on the West Bank and Gaza now is a kind of sullen acceptance of the status quo, but there's a tremendous seething unrest. Mm-hmm. Look, I mean, just last week, the Pope was in this refugee camp, Dehesha, in Bethlehem. The moment he left, there was a scuffle, and a full-scale riot broke out between the Palestinian police and the refugees in the camp, all of them. Because they're brutalizing the people. So I think brutal rule is brutal rule no matter where it takes place. And I've never accepted the theory that Arafat is the leader and we're in a tough position. We have to follow him. It just doesn't wash. It's gotten us into more trouble and gotten us nowhere. There's now, I think, an interesting movement in Palestinian life among the refugees. A movement to return, to assert our right to return, which has been asserted by the UN since 1948. Look what happened in Kosovo. The U.S. went to war in Kosovo.
Like the right of return to Israel. Something.
Yes, absolutely. The right to return to their homes.
Or to Kosovo.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's been asserted by the UN since 1948 in a resolution called 194, which says that all refugees have the right to return to their homes. And this is gathering a great deal of force. There's a big petition that's been signed by every independent Palestinian all over the world. And there's a conference in Boston tomorrow to talk about this and put it on the political agenda. And I think this is going to cause him some embarrassment because I think he just wants to forget about the refugees as being too too complicated.
You have children who... inherit your stake and your interest and your zeal. What's your vision for them and what's your hope for them?
Well, I think in the case of my son, my daughter is an actress and very interested in the arts and really not interested in politics. My son, who is a New York City kid, decided at an early age that he wanted to learn Arabic and taught himself Arabic and the most phenomenal command of the language I've ever seen. It's quite extraordinary. Then he went back. He got a Fulbright to Egypt. He spent a year on the West Bank, and he goes back all the time as a volunteer. He's a lawyer now. He's interested in public interest law and, immigration law and all the good causes that one can fight through the law. And I think he thinks of himself as a dual citizen of Palestine and of the United States, as many of us do.
But what's his hope? What is your hope in him? What's his hope for the kind of reconciliation that you also talk about at the human level?
Well, I think the history of the last 50 years has been a history of partitions that haven't worked. When the British left Palestine in 1948, they tried to divide it into an Arab and a Jewish state, and of course a Jewish state was born. This was supposed to produce the security and the end of violence and conflict. In fact, the splintering of communities into racial and ethnic and religious, in my opinion, ghettos, has produced more. We know this. I mean, look what happened between India and Pakistan after the partition. Look what happened in Ireland. Look what happened in Cyprus. Look what happened in the Balkans. I know it's very difficult to overcome these. And look what happened in Lebanon, where, the communities not only splintered but killed each other. My sole argument is that has to be overcome. You cannot live with ethnic and racial fear. And you have to find a way to live with the other, given, and this is, I think, the most important point with regard to Palestine, two things. Number one, that more than one people claims that place. You can't say it's exclusively the right of the Jews or of the Arabs. Both of them have equal right, in my opinion, in that place, number one. And number two, it's too small a place to divide. I mean, if you look at the area between Ramallah in the north and Bethlehem in the south, we're talking about 20 miles. North to south, that contains about 1 million people, Arabs and Jews. It's impossible to divide them. So you either find a way to have them live equitably together each in his own way, of course. But you cannot have one people with all the rights and the other without any rights. That's apartheid.
You know, when you get out of the law office, when you get onto the street, when you observe it as a, of course, an American, Palestinian, what do you take to be the possibilities and the real obstacles in this sort of very fundamental matter of living with the other? And how might it be solved in that 20-mile strip?
Yeah. Well, that problem has preoccupied me most of my life, intellectually and politically. I think it is the main problem. I think fear and ignorance are the two main factors here. That somehow that contact with the other will somehow threaten your identity. And second, I think we all have a kind of mythological view of identity as being a single thing that is basically intact and has to be protected. I think that's simply nonsense. History teaches us that all of us are mixed, that every individual is made up of several different, perhaps even competing strands, and that's to be cherished rather than trying to launder out the strands that are competitive and contradictory. I think one ought to encourage them to live well in the way in music. There's a thing called counterpoint where you manage the voices in a fugue. It makes it more interesting that there are more voices working together than less. And I think the same thing applies in society. And I think we're gradually moving in that direction. But there's
a lot.
That's
interesting, because you said this is the problem you've been struggling with intellectually, politically all your life.
Right.
Maybe that's the wrong way. I mean, intellectually, politically. Maybe we should be doing it emotionally, musically.
Yeah. Well.
Is that or?
Yeah, and intellectually, aesthetically, if you like, as well. Yeah.
Yeah, but be as concrete as you can. How you got there and what that adds to think of.
Well,
to,
you know,
to think
many
of
years...
these ancient hostilities as a kind of counterpoint.
Yeah, well, I'll explain to you, because one has to always factor in the role of the imagination and the fantasy. Many years ago, I wrote a book called Orientalism, which is really about how the Orient was a construction. It was a fantasy created by map makers, by poets, by administrators, that there was this place called the Orient where all the people were Orientals. They thought in the same way. They were different from us and so on and so forth. And what I tried to do in my book was to show that this was a vast construction. It had very little to do with what the Orient actually was. The Orient was much more varied, much more different, much more contradictory than all these people allowed. I think it's generally the case that people are much more complex than is allowed for in our stereotypes, you know, racial stereotypes or ethnic stereotypes. Now, I think the way to get over it is obviously direct encounters of one sort or another. And the tragedy of what's happening in the Middle East today is that the politics of all of these states, whether it's the Arab states or the Jewish state, is to encourage separation and difference rather than I mean, difference is there, obviously, but to turn difference into barrier rather than into encounters and enriching experience. I mean, yeah.
But in that sense, do you renounce, or not renounce exactly, but have you outgrown your own long, long investment in statehood for the Palestinians?
Yeah, it doesn't interest me. I mean, it doesn't.
It did.
Me.
I mean.
Well, yeah. I mean, I still think that if it was possible to have a state, I mean, a real state and a real piece of.
But you now put that in the sort of separation bag and throw it out.
Well, because I understand the logic of what's happening on the ground. I mean, a state today would mean, in effect, an Israeli protectorate. I mean, what's being forecast by the Oslo Accords is an enclosure of a few Palestinian territories on the West Bank amounting to about 20%, fully controlled by the authority, with no borders with any Arab country. For example, the border with Jordan would be interceded by a border with Israel. Do you understand what I mean?
Sure.
Israel would control the Jordan River. The same in the borders with Egypt. Now, it seems to me that a state of that sort is really basically a ghetto. It's a little colony. It doesn't allow the people to live their lives as full and equal human beings. It doesn't mean self-determination. Mm-hmm. Whereas what they now have is something that I think can lead to a kind of self-determination, namely integration within one large state, which would include Jews, Christians, and Muslims.
When did you come to that, and how? It seems that's a really important turn away from the endless battle for statehood and sovereignty and sort of nationalism into this other very, very different alternative of some sort of integrated democracy.
Hmm. Well, it was my original idea was that is to say, a notion of an integrated democracy, a kind of. I've never really been, you know, because of my history, which I wrote about in my memoir, I've never really felt to be myself to be part of a state in the conventional sense of the word, and I think that. You know, I've never believed that the solution to one's problem is to have, a country to which one belongs in the sense that that will solve all my problems. I've been basically cosmopolitan. I've traveled a lot. I've lived in different places, and I felt always slightly uprooted. But you know, there was this drive to getting us our place in the sun. Palestinians who would, you know. 30 years ago, nobody could pronounce the word Palestinians. We were told that we didn't exist as a people. So the assertion and the affirmation of nationalism to say that we do exist seemed to me important. Pretty soon it ran into the obvious problems. It ran into the pettiness of nationalism, of a kind of fanaticism, which I've always disliked. And then I started to study the history of nationalism in the Third World, and I noticed that very rare were its critics. Its critics were really in a minority. But occasionally people, you know, like Tagore in India, understood that Indian nationalism was tending towards chauvinism and had far exceeded any of its earlier uses as an instrument of liberation. I think what for me was the important thing was the distinction between nationalism and liberation. And I saw that nationalism could sidetrack the kind of liberation that I think people are entitled to after years of misery, the right to lead full lives, to express themselves, and so on. I think that's where the transformation came.
You also draw a big distinction between what governments are capable of, which is mainly flattering and sort of monopolizing power with each other, and what people are capable of at the ground. What encourages you at the ground level to think that Arabs and Israelis in the West Bank, in Jerusalem for that matter, could treat each other as effectively as equals?
Well, let me just speak about my own experiences with Israelis, you know, which have been really quite extraordinary. In the last 4 or 5 years, I've spoken in Israeli associations. I mean, there was a kind of taboo for Palestinians to do that. But I decided it was a silly idea, and I thought I should do it. Some of my work is being translated into Hebrew. Courses are taught on my work in several of the Israeli universities, and I went and I started to talk to Israeli academics, and I found that there was quite a stunning variety of opinion there. They weren't all, as many of us had thought, they weren't all, you know, Zionists in the simple sense of the word. There were people who actually believed, for example, in binationalism. There were those who believed in the need for Israel to have a constitution, which is a state it doesn't have. There were those who believed that the idea of a state being run by religious authorities was counter to their interests as secular Jews, and so on and so forth.
There were also the new historians who took a somewhat Palestinian view of...
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a Palestinian view. No. I mean, I'd like to say it's an objective view. It's what history, what the records, Israeli records tell us, that they drove Palestinians out. And, you know, a few Israeli historians actually wrote that when the archives were declassified, you know, about 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So all of that seemed to me to be a territory worth exploring. Which, alas, is not too much explored by Palestinians who are not in the fortunate position as I am to have jobs in New York and so on and so forth. So I said, well, why not take advantage of it and do it?
Is it fair to think of you as a man who's evolved in a way from militant intellectual to the Rodney King of this scene?
No. I mean, I'm still a militant intellectual. I mean, I still, my tongue is very sharp, and I, you know, I give and trade blows with people who, you know, who disagree with me. I mean, that's part of the deal. But I think there are other relationships and other avenues that I explore that I think are more, to me, more interesting than just polemic.
Let's explore them. And thank you for being here. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Edward Said, literature professor at Columbia University, musician, scholar, everyman, Renaissance man of Palestinian politics, too. 1-800-423-TALK. Shalom is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Shalom.
Professor Said, you are not to flatter. You're obviously the most sophisticated and prominent Arab intellectuals in the world today. You may be too modest to admit it. And you propose basically the most sophisticated, if intentionally or unintentionally, just in good faith, I have no way of knowing, formula for destruction of Israel as a Zionist and, in fact, Jewish state. Because if Israel permitted, agreed to, to make a joint state with all the Palestinians, of whom from the original few hundred thousand refugees who either willingly or unwillingly left the area of what was then Palestine and became about 5 or 6 million people now. There are fewer than 5 million Jews in Israel. They would, by simple democratic election, if they chose to, dissolve this Israel as a Zionist state, as a Jewish state, and could do all kind of things by simple democratic means. Now you can say, well, this is just a theoretical, it's a McVeighan theory, not that many will
come. It's
also
democratic.
What?
It's also democratic.
It's also democratic. But if...
Not so bad, really.
Yes, and in theory, this is a beautiful messianic idea. In practice, if Israel agreed to a certain number on principle and later refused, this would be continuous cause for struggle and war. And in fact, as I'm sure you know, there were professors, intellectuals on your own level in Israel, president of Hebrew University, Magnus, Martin Buber, a famous philosopher and theologian, Aaron Simon, who wanted to have a joint state. And they found...
Shalom, you've made your point that you think a joint state or an equal state would be destructive of Israel. Edward Said, what do you think?
Look, I follow your argument. You know, our views are not that different. But consider this. First of all, you said democratic change. I think that's very important. Second of all, by the year 2010, that is to say 10 years from now, there will be demographic parity between Arabs and Jews. I think you can't ignore the fact that already 20% of Israel's population is not Jewish but Palestinian. If you add the Palestinians on the West Bank and Gaza and factor in the rate of increase in the population growth, as I said, by the year 2010, they will be equal in number. What do you do then?
Take a deep breath and collect your thoughts. Edward Said is our guest. We're talking about the Middle East. Of course, you're listening to The Connection. You were saying?
Oh, sorry. My idea is that once you have that demographic parity, then the idea would be to invent creative ways by which these populations, which are impinging on each other, which live on top of each other, have to live together. And certain structures of the past, which discriminate against Palestinians and maybe discriminate against Jews as well on the Palestinian side, simply will not work.
Shalom, do you want to jump in again or not?
Yes, I just want to finish my previous sentence, that those professors of Hebrew University, before there was Israeli state, wanted peaceful togetherness with Arabs. They were having only one major, you can find it, I.F. Stone's book, who was sympathetic to Palestinian. There was only one Arab, a poet from the Husseini clan, who agreed to talk to them.
But you're talking about events 70 years ago. There's been a major transformation of the area.
I know, but do you...
No, let me just finish, because you're saying things that need to be qualified. At the time you're talking about, Arabs were the two-thirds majority of Palestine in the 1930s. Why should they feel that they should give up their territory to 5% of the population? The Israel had not been established. We're talking about a movement for binationalism that was, to most Arabs on the ground, a theoretical possibility. The whole situation is transformed totally now, in that there is a large Jewish population, there is also a large Palestinian and Arab population, and all around Israel and Palestine there is now a huge Muslim Arab majority. What is the proposal for living together? Is it the way of the past, or is there some new way that would enable the end of violence and a kind of relationship that doesn't hold on to the mentality of the chauvinist and the sort of frightened, fragile identity? Let me give you an example. A couple of weeks ago, there was a major debate in the Knesset, instituted by a proposal by the education minister, Yossi Sarid, who's a liberal, who suggested that as an option for the Hebrew curriculum, high school curriculum, students get the option to choose to read one Palestinian poem by Mahmoud Darwish, who is our national poet. There were two no-confidence motions brought against the government that the reading of a Palestinian poem might corrupt the minds of Israeli youth. I mean, this kind of thinking in which the reading of a poem is so threatening to such a fragile identity has to be superseded, has to be moved along to another stage where people read each other's poetry without fear. That's what I'm talking about.
Shalom, it's your turn.
Yeah, but Professor Said, do you see that your formula is formula for destruction of Israel as
I'm not talking
Jewish
about the
state?
Yes, I'm not talking
about.
Do
you admit that fact?
Look, I'm not talking about the destruction of anything. I'm talking about the transformation of the state that would allow all the citizens of the state, Arabs and Jews. Now, Arab citizens of the states don't of the state of Israel don't have the same rights as Jews. Do you admit that?
Do you admit?
No, I'm just asking you. Do you?
Yes.
Exactly. It's a state for Jews in which there are non-Jews. So I'm saying, by natural transformation, by the democratic process, the franchise—not the franchise—they have the franchise, but the rights, the right to own land, the right to access, to privilege, and so on and so forth—is not restricted only to Jews. That's all I'm saying.
But I see you didn't let me finish my sentence. I admit it, but the degree of differential is so much smaller than what happens to people like the Kurds in Iraq and to various minorities, of which none of the 21 or 22 Arab states reads any Jewish poets or permits democracy. In other words, you want idealized absolute democracy
only
in Israel. You didn't
think
about
any
Arab state. You don't ask it of them.
Look, there is no absolute democracy anywhere. There isn't any in the Arab states. And
except on the connection.
Yes. There isn't any absolute democracy. But one that doesn't mean that one doesn't struggle for it. I'm not.
Hold the thought. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with our guest, Edward Said. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. From Boston University, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Edward Said Connection. E minor sonata for piano and violin.
Cello,
performed by Edward Said's friend Daniel Barenboim and the late Jacqueline Desprez. You know, there's always a Brahms connection. There were people who really thought after World War I, Brahms's music would heal Germany. Mm-hmm. And in listening to this, you sort of wonder, could it heal all of us maybe, but could it heal the Middle East?
No, I doubt it. But I mean, it could produce quite extraordinary configurations. Like the one that we did last summer in Weimar, which, you know, was the cultural capital of Europe. And they asked Yo-Yo Ma and
Daniel. It was where Brahms met Schumann, wasn't it?
I don't know.
Liszt
lived there for a while. And of course,
and Brahms fell asleep when Liszt played his sonata for him.
And Goethe lived there for 50 years. But it was quite an extraordinary thing because we brought together about 80 young musicians from the Middle East, you know, who were auditioned quite carefully over a period of 6 months from all of the Arab countries and Israel. And they came to this little town in East Germany, and it was an astonishing period of about 3 weeks. Yo-Yo and Daniel gave master classes, and Daniel conducted and drilled the orchestra. And it was amazing. And I had led these discussions at night with the students, who were all very gifted musicians. And it was quite interesting at the beginning how many edgy people there were, and there were hostilities and all kinds of things. And by the end of the 2.5 or 3 weeks that they were there, quite a different thing had happened. An orchestra had been born. Now, I mean, I don't think there's any political fallout from that, except that, you know, it's just a new pattern that I think has a role to play in providing models for different kinds of relationships between not just Arabs and Jews, but between Arabs among themselves. I mean, there were many Arabs who had never met other Arabs there. And for them, it was an interesting encounter. And it all came about because of this quite extraordinary power of a figure like Barenboim, who is, you know, who's an amazing musician and a great sort of communicator at the same time.
You've written very movingly to me about your friendship with Barenboim, and it's not about an Arab being a friend of a Jew. It's about two men who sort of saw each other in a line in London and immediately recognized the profoundest kind of human sympathy.
Yeah, but we also share one thing in common, which is that we're never stopped by the ordinary barriers that separate people. I mean, Barenboim as a pianist is somebody who's always reaching across the footlights, you know, to solicit the attention of his listeners and his audience. And in my own work, that's what I try to do. I mean, there's no other reason for writing and speaking unless you're trying to engage the interest and make them part of your enterprise with your readers and listeners. So I think in that, and we both have, this is the, I think, the important thing, we both have a tremendous interest in the Middle East as a place of possibility, not because there are these separations, but because there are these mixtures. You know, neither of us lives there. I mean, Daniel lives in Berlin and Chicago, and I live in New York, but the Middle East is important to us as a place to go back to. And it's a place that's interesting to us because of the incredible variety of lives that there and cultures that it's possible to excavate. Mm-hmm. And I know from his point of view, the discovery of, you know, going into an Arab home, for example, which he did for the first time when we went to one in Ramallah a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. was for him like a major adventure. Because, he said, in his own background, growing up as a young musician in Israel back in the 50s, he had no knowledge of what the Arabs were like, although they were next door. And one of the things he's very interested in doing, for example, is learning Arabic. And actually made an announcement at a concert he gave in Jerusalem, which I attended, a recital, in which he said, you know, he was outraged by the fact that the program was in English and in Hebrew, but not in Arabic. Hmm. And so that notion of dissipating boundaries that are usually quite, in the end, quite mechanical and not worth maintaining, I think is very much part of this.
Do you and he talk about politics, or is that part all simply implicit?
No, we do talk about politics, although, you know, we don't obviously agree on everything. I mean, his idea of what happened in the history of the Middle East really begins, I think, with 1967, with the moment, he says, when the Jews, for the first time in their history, acquired a subject population. For me, the history of the Middle East begins, I mean, the problems in the Middle East begins in 1948 with the dispossession of the Palestinians and the destruction of Palestine. So, we agree that there's a problem. But I think we both agree that the solution, the present peace process of separation and the attempt to set up a kind of phony entity, et cetera, is not going to lead anywhere. Mm-hmm. And he was the first Israeli musician to come to the Palestinian National Conservatory in Ramallah and play a recital. I mean, it was a major step for him, but it was also a major step for Palestinians who think of Israelis, especially in Ramallah and Bir Zeit, which is where it was, as basically an army of occupation. And even Israelis who are well-intentioned are still thought of with hostility because their troops are there, right? But he came, and it was a flawless evening. I mean, there were about 500 people, and he completely charmed. He donated his, it was really quite extraordinary.
What did he play?
Well, I'll tell you what he played. He started out with the Appassionata, with the Pathetique Sonata of Beethoven. He then played the Opus 109, E major, number 30 of Beethoven, intermission. He then played a selection of Chopin pieces, including the Fantasy in F minor. And I think he ended with an Albanius piece. It was a full program. I mean, it was a big program. And then, as an extra encore, I had arranged that a young Palestinian pianist, a very gifted pianist, who is from Nazareth, come and play a four-hand piece with him. And they played a Schubert Marche Militaire. I mean, it was a stunning evening. Zubin Mehta was there, and he told me and Daniel that he had never been to the West Bank. He'd been conducting the Israel Philharmonic for 30 years. He's never set foot outside of Tel Aviv. His tears were steaming down his face at this quite extraordinary event. No, it was a, well, I mean, so out of
invite
out
us
of such
all
moments,
next time,
I think the future are amazing.
Good. Invite us the next time.
We'll, I will.
We'll,
I will,
we'll broadcast it live. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Edward Said. Raj is on the line. Hello, Raj.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. My question is about Professor Said's theory in general, and I agree with so much, and I've learned a lot from his work, but I wonder what to do with witnessing, or in other words, the situation when people feel an ethical call to convert or save the other, to eliminate difference, and therefore they can't live with difference. So what would you say about those cases?
Oh, I'm totally against it. Don't forget that the history of my particular community, the Christian community in Syria and Palestine, is one of converts. I mean, we were converted from Orthodox Christianity to the, in my case, the Protestant Church, and I think the idea of converting people is from one sect to another. Goes deeply against my own interests. First of all, I'm a very secular person. I'm not interested in trying to convert people. But I think the way I'd put it is I'm interested in engaging them in discussion and debate rather than trying to turn them into new converts. I mean, the whole idea of a convert is something that fills me with dread.
So what about? But do you, I mean, there are people who feel that it's their moral obligation, right, to do this.
Yeah.
And they're sincere in feeling this.
Well, I mean, I wish I could say I wish them well, but they're not, they don't really interest me. I mean, their enterprise is not something that concerns me a great deal because I am secular, because I'm basically skeptical. And whole, you know, full conversions from one total belief to another are things that make me very, very suspicious, given that the part of the world from which I come is full of those kinds of transformations. And enthusiasm in general of that kind, of total kind of mind-obliterating experiences, are things that I think are very, very dangerous, and one ought to really warn against them and fight against them if possible. I understand that people might feel an ethical obligation to convert, but and to convert others, but I myself don't share it, and I find myself deeply against it.
Raj, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Hill is on the line.
Hello. I wish we could all share your idyllic vision of the new Middle East. And I'm certainly glad you brought up the issue of curriculum and culture, Dr. Said. I wish you would comment on what would seem a glaring exception to your vision, and that's Palestinian education in elementary and high schools.
It's perfectly horrible.
Well, excuse me, but if one were listening to your arguments, one would think that there was this idyllic culture.
I didn't say that.
Israel only opened its borders, that they would be welcomed by Palestinians. The textbooks that are published by Palestinians today, which were published only a year or two ago, which are not Jordanian or Egyptian textbooks, are rife with not simply anti-Zionism or anti-Israel rhetoric, but actual anti-Semitic teachings, which are reminiscent of...
Could you name one, just so I can look it up?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Our Arabic language for the eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Our Arabic
Who wrote
language
it? Who's the author? Who's the author?
I don't have them in front of me, but you can look them up on the internet if you'd like to.
Okay. And where are they taught? Which schools?
Address?
Could you tell me which schools they're taught in?
They're taught in Ramallah. They're taught in
which schools in Ramallah?
They're taught in Nablus.
I see. Okay.
Okay, Israeli textbooks, on the other hand, one I'm looking at right now, says how we can live with our Arab neighbors. So unfortunately, some of the things you seem to say seem to fall into the rubric, if it sounds too good to be true, then it just might be.
No, I think the... Can I just reply?
Sure.
Yeah. Look, I think what you're saying is basically true. I think the level of education, primary education in the Arab countries, and I think in Israel, by the way, is deeply chauvinist. It's highly defensive. The Knesset debate was one instance, the one I talked about earlier. I didn't at all mean to imply that things on the other side were rosy. I didn't say that at all. And I quite resent the notion that what I'm talking about is idyllic. I'm simply talking about the need for change. The situation is bad, and I think it needs to be looked at as it is bad, and transformed into something better. And one way of doing that, I agree with you completely, is through education. And there's no reason to tolerate any of the ethnic or racial or religious stereotypes, alas, that exist both in Arab textbooks and in Jewish textbooks, where, for example, the plus sign is not even allowed to be used because it's supposed to betoken the Christian cross. I mean, that kind of prejudice and ignorance, I think, is simply intolerable, just as the anti-Semitic and other ethnic things that you talked about. I haven't seen them myself, but I have no reason to doubt that you're not telling the truth. But the point is that there is a state of war, and war, as we know, in any situation, look at the Japanese-American situation during World War II. They were full of the most hideous racial stereotypes and caricatures thought of as part of a state of war. And I think one way of transforming this is to enable people to feel, well, look, our identities don't depend so much on fighting the existence of another, but on coming to terms with it. And that's what I'm talking about. It's not idyllic. I think it's necessary.
Hill, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Peter is on the line.
Well, I had several comments. One is there's a doctrine in American law, the Clean Hands Doctrine, which says basically you should be careful about accusing others of something of which you may be guilty yourself. That's not really precisely what it is, but I'm curious whether Professor Saeed has ever in his long career denounced in the Arab countries the treatment of virtually every non-Arab or non-Muslim group. I'm thinking in particular of the Berbers. He surely must have met Berber exiles in his wanderings in Paris, and he knows that a number of them have been killed recently. He knows about the riots, I assume, in Tizi Ouzou and Tamanhasset. He knows that the Berber language is forbidden and has been forced Arabization of the original inhabitants in Algeria. There are
the question, Peter, is whether he has criticized this kind of thing.
It's about the fact that everywhere in the so-called and misnamed Arab world.
Why is it misnamed?
The Copts, the Berbers, the blacks in the Sudan, and then I would guess the Maronites in Lebanon. These are the four major either non-Muslim or non-Arab group.
Well, I belong to one of those groups myself, actually. I'm a member of a Christian minority.
Are you a member of the Copts?
No, I'm not, but I'm a member of an even smaller minority.
I'm now asking you, don't you find it peculiar that the Arabs who constructed after 1967 this Palestinian Arab people... So that
well, I mean, are you giving us a speech? Look,
no, I
know what you're asking me, and I denounce any type of racial or religious or ethnic discrimination, whether it takes place in the Arab world or elsewhere. Is that all right? I mean, I have. I really don't feel I need to answer every one of your comments here because I can answer them all.
Do you want to speak to the construction of the Palestinian people after 67 or not?
I don't know what he refers to. It's quite interesting. Coming up on the plane yesterday, I read an article in the New Republic, which sounds very much like what he's talking about, and I think he's simply repeating the argument. It's okay. I don't need to reply to it just this minute.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Edward Said connection. Carl is calling from a car phone in Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi. Hello.
Hello, Carl. Welcome.
Hello, Professor Saeed. This is Carl Senna. I'm a columnist with the Providence Journal and also a longtime aficionado of Dr. Saeed and his work and a friend of the Palestinian people. And I thank you. I think it was you or someone related to you who wrote a note commenting on the column I wrote about the Arab American Anti-Discrimination annual meeting in Arlington, Virginia last year.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm calling two things. One, you described the binational state. Would it be possible, you know, where the Palestinians have 20% of the land? And
Carl, I just want to interrupt to say you're listening to The Connection. Carl, go ahead.
And, I came from Roxbury, Massachusetts, and grew up there, and we lived among Irish Americans. I'm a mixed African American and Mexican, and there were also other groups there. And at the time that I was there, during the 50s and 60s, when great turmoil, there were heroic types, Reverend Michael Haynes, my mentor, and other people like that in Roxbury, and they were able to forge a new Boston, which is still not settled, but at least it has some degree of harmony that I never knew. And I just wondered if, you know, individuals like yourself, you know, could find individuals in both communities, in the Jewish and Arab communities, who would be able to, you know, lead the way, like Bishop Tutu in South Africa, et cetera. The other question is about your book. You know, there were a great deal of criticism about it because they said that some people said in Commentary Magazine particularly that you had fabricated some aspects of your early growing up and that you weren't really legitimately a Palestinian. I just wondered if you could, you know, what are you doing about that as well? But
Carl, thanks for the call. The question is clear.
Well, look, the first point you made, look, I think there is actually a new constituency. It's just not being allowed to be heard or seen or act. I mean, I think there are a lot of people. The polls show it. There are a lot of Israelis. There are a lot of Palestinians. There are a lot of Arabs. There are a lot of Arab Americans who now believe, in effect, that a binational state in Palestine, that some arrangement that goes beyond the miserable little Bantustans and the little the settlements with their barbed wires and the incredible militarization of the place, can't be a portent of the future. I mean, it's going no place. They've divided the land up so much that there is no room to move in it anymore. And of course, an entire people is still dispossessed. So I think a lot of Israelis feel strongly that some new arrangement has to be made. And of course, we're now in the stage where we're only able to explore these things verbally, the way we're doing now, and through associations and through meetings and exchanging of ideas. But I'm convinced that there is a major change taking place on the ground inside Israel, inside the Palestinian community, as a result of unhappiness with what the peace process, which was supposed to do all these wonderful things, has not done. Palestinians are poorer, Israelis are not any more secure, and the whole thing is simply ended in a kind of stalemate with going no place fast. That's number one. Number two, it does seem to me that a new generation is the only hope. That is to say, those people, not me, not my generation, but my children's generation, where the hobbles of the past, where the legacy of the past is not so heavy. And there are still commitments. There's a feeling of attachment to the place and some sense that the future is ours to construct, and it's not going to be done by them, whoever they are, the leaders or the other people. I think that is the only way to get us out of the mess we're in right now. This idea, which I've been very critical of from the beginning, that the United States, just because Clinton wants it for his election, or at the time for his election and for his presidency, to have a peace process going, is not going to produce the peace. The people are the ones who are going to have to. I mean, Egypt has had a peace with Israel for over 20 years, and no Egyptian of any note wants anything to do with Israel, despite the peace agreement. Now, that's not a blueprint for other peace agreements. The same is true the peace agreement between Jordan and Israel. There's no interaction at all between them. So what is the solution? And that's really what I'm talking about. What is the alternative?
Carl also asked a question. I don't want to belabor it, but about your identity as a refugee, as a Palestinian, as a child of Jerusalem, or were you a child of a Egyptian family living in Cairo and all this kind of thing?
No, my family was, that's very funny. My parents were both Palestinian. My father was born in Jerusalem. My mother was born in Nazareth. And my father lived in Cairo. I never said I was a refugee, but the rest of my family was. My entire extended family was driven out of Palestine by the spring of 1948.
And in that sense, the thematic title, Out of Place, seemed to me was entirely sustained by that book.
Yeah.
I wish we could talk all day, and maybe we should find a way to do it again. It's been enormously interesting. Edward Said, I should have said at the beginning, Edward Said's autobiography is called Out of Place, a memoir of his early years. His newest book, out next week, is called The End of the Peace Process, Oslo and After. We'll go out as we came in the second half here with Daniel Barenboim and Jacqueline Dupre playing Brahms. Edward Said, thank you very, very much for joining us, and let's do it again soon.
Thank you very much.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Legal Seafood's Marketplace at Chestnut Hill. Voted Boston's best fish market by the Improper Bostonian 1999. Online shopping available at LegalSeafoods.com. By Puritan Press.